welcome to Islam for Christians, episode 139. Islamic history, the year 625. The expulsion of the Banu Nadir. A while back, just before we were talking about the Battle of Uhud, about a year before the Battle of Uhud, in real time, not our time, we went over the assassination of a Jewish tribal leader called Ka'ab ibn al-Ashraf. Now, if you remember, this man was killed by Muslims, allegedly for anti-Muhammad poetry, probably, or maybe in addition, possibly raising troops for a mutiny. It really depends on who you believe in this aspect. But the Muslims, they killed this poet. We know that happened. And the poet's tribe was the Banu Nadir. And the Banu Nadir were understandably upset by this. And Muhammad, he's not dumb, he knows this. And so he said this to this tribe regarding their dead poet. He said, "If he had remained as others of like opinion remain, he would not have been killed by guile. But he did us injury and wrote poetry against us. And none of you shall do this, but he shall be put to the sword." And let me translate that in modernese. He's basically saying, you may hate me, and that's okay. That's fine. I can live with it. Just keep it to yourself, and you'll be fine. However, if you criticize me in public, we are going to have a huge problem, and I just might have you killed. Now, that was about a year before the Battle of Uhud. So let's fast forward 1 year. The Battle of Uhud is over. Now, as I have contended, this was a draw at worst and likely a Muslim victory. But as I noted before, my opinion doesn't really count. Especially back then, it doesn't count. Because Muhammad saw it as a loss, the Muslims saw it as a loss, and the non-Muslims of Medina also saw it as a loss. And this is a big part of what made the Banu Nadir potentially dangerous, more so than before. Now, you may remember the complaints that got Ka'ab the poet killed a year earlier, and prompted that stern warning to the Banu Nadir I just read you. Now, at the time, they were pretty good complaints with plausible logic. The most dangerous kinds of complaints, really. They were basically, well, number one, the Jews had forfeited their honor when they agreed to let Muhammad rule them. This is what he was telling the people. And I think a lot of them heard some truth in that. And then number two, he would tell them, what quarrel did the Jews of Medina have with the Quraysh? What did the Quraysh ever do to us, the Banu Nadir tribe? Why should we be fighting the Quraysh? If you remember, this man, Muhammad, he came to bring peace between the Aus and Khazraj, only to turn around and start a war with a whole new tribe? Again, another pretty valid point if you are a member of the Banu Nadir and a non-Muslim member of Medina. You know, and then he would also say, I would say a third thing he told them was, wasn't Muhammad's reckless campaign against these people, meaning the Quraysh, wasn't he putting the city in unnecessary danger with this action? Another pretty good point. So we have these ideas that got this poet killed before Uhud. Now, after Uhud, all these points still remained. In fact, they were stronger. The Meccans had actually attacked Medina and very well could have routed the entire city. They lost a battle and had no reason to believe that they would win the next one. And in history, generally, leaders of this time and type, of the type of leaders we're talking about in this time and place, particularly old-style leaders and or more autocratic leaders, and certainly ones claiming to have a mandate from God like Muhammad did, these types of leaders are naturally vulnerable after a failed military campaign. Now, you might see where this is going. This is a ripe situation for an overthrow or a rebellion or some kind of action against the person currently in charge. But that didn't really happen, at least not from the Banu Nadir. They did not fight at Uhud, this is true, but pacifism is not the same thing as treachery. Being against a war is really not the same thing as being for the other side. And again, there was no open revolt. You know, but things sometimes escalate out of control anyway, and this certainly did. You know, we'll get to what happened eventually. But this is how it started. There was a murder, which really wasn't that huge a deal in ancient Arabia. And who it was isn't even really that important, except that I believe it involved a Banu Nadir member and a Muslim. And so the truly important part here is that there would have to be a negotiation for blood money to be paid because of this murder. And this would mean a discussion between Muhammad and the Banu Nadir. So Muhammad meets with them, but somehow slips out of the meeting. And the next thing you know, he's saying that the Banu Nadir were going to assassinate him. Now, how did Muhammad know this? Well, apparently, according to some sources, the angel Gabriel told him. Or some other sources say it was one of his companions who told him. But the more common story is usually that Gabriel told Muhammad that the Banu Nadir wanted to assassinate him, that they were going to assassinate him. And Muhammad would act on this information in a very severe way. But first, a quick caution here. Now, this history, this particular story about how Muhammad came to know this, whenever it was written, it's not something that should be taken at face value by believers or non-believers alike, because the story isn't even certain of itself in this case. And there is a great deal of confusion surrounding the episode. And a major reason for this confusion is that there really are conflicting stories here, and quite literally in the same story, in the same paragraph. For example, the Ibn Ishaq history, one of the earliest complete Muslim histories of Muhammad. This actually starts with Muhammad himself overhearing the plot to kill him, then quoting the men who planned to drop a rock on his head from the roof. So Muhammad hears a plot to drop a giant rock on his head, and then he gets up and he goes back to his home in Medina. And there, this is where things get a tad disjointed, when at home in Medina, a divine source tells him about the plot. So after this, the story goes, Muhammad then ordered his men to prepare for war. So the hole in this story isn't really that hard to see. There is a mistake in there somewhere. The news either had to come from Muhammad or from the heavens. But both? That really doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right? It has to be one or the other, unless you're going to, say, argue that the angel Gabriel reinforced what he had already heard. But, I mean, he heard what he heard, and he left because he heard it, because any sensible person would leave if you were hearing that they were about to kill you. And there's also, you know, more practical questions, like, if there was a plot, do you seriously think anyone would say anything within earshot of Muhammad? I mean, really, wouldn't you know where he was at all times? And the revelation from heaven, yeah, that's possible. You know, that's not impossible. But if Muhammad got a revelation from heaven regarding this, why isn't that revelation in the Quran? Isn't he supposed to relay these things to his followers, you know, as he usually would do? Is it possible some random companion really did overhear the plot? I mean, yeah, that's plausible too, and unknowable. It's also possible the historian simply wrote down what he heard verbatim without bothering to curate or pass judgment on what he was being told by whoever it was that was telling him this story. I mean, maybe. Again, who knows? Especially because there are only Muslim sources here. There's nothing from the Banu Nadir that corroborates any of this. And that's history. We don't know. We'll never know. It's not like Muhammad wrote some kind of definitive autobiography with his side of the story in it. Neither did the Banu Nadir, so we're left with pieces and legends. The only thing we know for sure is that Muhammad moved against the Banu Nadir, and you can guess who came out on top. Of course, that part is obvious, as is the fact that this episode, this is the first instance, you could say, or first major episode or event in the uglier chapters of Jewish-Muslim conflict. You know, the link to our present is also obvious. But what actually started this whole thing is not so obvious. Now, despite what the history books say, the actual reason the Muslims decided to come at the Banu Nadir is not crystal clear, at least in the details. But if you want to kind of read between the lines and parse out a primary reason, if you're looking at this not through a Muslim lens or even a religious lens, but through the lens of raw power, the reason can look very clear if you are a particularly cynical person. Because the Banu Nadir, from a Muslim military perspective, they were unreliable at best and potentially treacherous at worst. And like I said before, the Muslims had just lost a battle. If this was written, that lost would be in quotes, but the lost part was very important. Traditionally, as in usually, historically, after a military loss, what do leaders do to reconsolidate power? Well, one major popular way to do this is you make an example of someone. Now, for a more secular historian, particularly a cynical one, the temptation to view this episode as a raw power play would be immense. To see Muhammad as a leader in search of a fake because, in search of some reason, any reason, to get rid of this particularly annoying tribe and send a message to the other tribes as well. And this is a dangerous tribe. The Banu Nadir, they are dangerous to Muhammad and to his plans for Medina. You know, that's, regardless of where you fall on this, that's real. They're not dangerous in imagination. That's a hard reality. And you can't really lose sight of that. Whatever you may think of the circumstances, if Muhammad is being a responsible leader, this is something that had to be addressed. I mean, maybe not in a specific way in the events that followed, but something had to be done. This wasn't something you could just ignore. And if Muhammad did indeed create a fake because, if he did run his own false flag op here, it wasn't because there wasn't a compelling underlying reason. There definitely was. And again, whether that reason makes it a moral action or not is certainly up to you. But again, I do want to stress that this wasn't just something that was done on a whim. But you can also see the moral danger here, particularly when you're talking about someone who's claiming to be the messenger of God. Now, this is a situation you see all the time in history. It's very common. And you will see some very, very horrible things rationalized in this kind of a situation. And it's present here too. The moral danger is clear. It's just the quick rationalizations that are just begging to be made. It's an easy justification to rationalize some extreme things, even for a good-hearted person or a national entity. Let's take my country, for example. The United States has entered many wars in the past 200 years, and a decent percentage of them were entered on some very iffy premises. The oldest, most obvious one being the Mexican-American War, the various Indian Wars, the Spanish-American War, World War I, Vietnam, pretty much any war in the Middle East. These were entered with the best of intentions by the men in charge, at least in their own minds. But often it really would come with a heavy dose of nonsense along the way. You know, but morally, the major question is, do the ends justify the means here? Because from the perspective of the side that is gaining from this, you really can't argue the results. You know, some of these wars were just massive winners for America. You know, I'm not talking about Vietnam and Iraq. I mean, I'm talking before that. You know, these major wars that wildly increased the territory of the United States, and sometimes not even major wars, say by the standards of World War II, is some of this land was gotten very, very cheaply by modern standards. Now, we'd have far fewer resources without Texas and California and Colorado and all those others. How different does history look if the California Gold Rush and the early industrial oil boom, what if that happened in Mexico instead of the United States? It would have been a very unstable continent for sure, possibly. Just imagine a powerful USA and Mexico going at each other like England and France, or, you know, later Germany and the rest of the continent. It would be very, very different. Now, for Muhammad, this was a smaller skirmish than any of those wars, but the stakes were arguably just as high because of the proximity to home. Think of it as Muhammad's Cuban Missile Crisis. It wasn't so much that he really needed the land the Banu Nadir were occupying. That would be a nice bonus, much like America's wars, the 19th century West, Gadsden Purchase, or something like that. But the more important thing was that they were right there on his doorstep. He had to be careful. So do you hope for the best, or do you blockade Cuba until the threat is gone? Well, Muhammad would choose to blockade Cuba. Just to be clear, the Banu Nadir are Cuba in this situation. But was there really a plot to kill Muhammad? Were the Banu Nadir really planning a revolt? Now, we don't know, but it doesn't really matter. The possibility was probably enough. And going back to the death of Ka'ab a year earlier, in a strange sort of way, that had sealed the fate of the Banu Nadir. What they had done afterward kind of sealed their fate. Now, yes, they were epically dangerous for all the reasons we have discussed, but there was one more thing that was probably the icing on the cake here. Now, listen to this part closely, because for a modern person, this can be very confusing. I would have never thought of this myself, but just follow me here. Back when Ka'ab was killed, the Banu Nadir tribe never sought revenge. They never sought any kind of revenge for that killing. So, in our eyes, that looks like a fully cowed and submissive tribe. Surely not a threat, right? Wrong. Muhammad probably did not see it that way. Again, this may be hard to follow. You really have to try and remove yourself from our present culture and chain of logic. Just put on your ancient thinking cap and some very thick irony glasses as well for this one. Now, like I said, this is not something I thought of. This is not my observation, but of Montgomery Watt, one of the more famous historians of this period. And it's as brilliant as it is perplexing to the modern mind. Why would Muhammad have considered the Banu Nadir so dangerous? Here it is. The Banu Nadir were dangerous because they had never taken any revenge for the killing of Ka'ab. Some revenge or a demand or something. It should be expected in that circumstance. This was basic Arabic thinking at the time. So, basically, stay with me here. The Muslim worry was that the Banu Nadir were surely going to kill somebody soon and act against the Muslims. It was inevitable. Now, why? Because the Banu Nadir hadn't killed anyone yet. The Banu Nadir were not seeking revenge. They heeded Muhammad's warning and were acting docile and subservient. So, they are set on war because they are acting so peacefully. They will try to assassinate Muhammad because they haven't tried to do so yet. Their lack of hostility was itself a hostile act. Now, according to Watt, that's how it would have been understood within the Arab culture at the time. Now, if that is correct, how's that for a brain bender? It really is hard to put yourself in that headspace, isn't it? And on my end, it's so hard to explain that coherently and try to even do it dryly and avoid saying this with some kind of, or without some kind of smug modern attitude toward these people in the past. But the crazy truth is, to the people that lived there at the time, these things that seem so incredibly stupid to us, they were critical for anyone navigating the world at that time. In an earlier episode, I was less than charitable about what I tend to see often, with the smug perspective of a modern man, to be the performative nonsense in ancient societies. But in this case, here you see the importance of playing the game, of participating in the performative nonsense, right? It has to be played. It doesn't matter how stupid it is, because performative nonsense sometimes saves lives. It's an unfortunate but unavoidable aspect of the human condition. You do the silly dance, even if you do not want to do the silly dance. It might mean your life. Would it have been different if the Banu Nadir had made a token aggressive act, one that was designed to fail but save face? Would it have been different? Maybe. Now, can submission really signal aggression? Now, in this case, at least if Watt is correct, yeah, maybe. You know, sometimes this is just the downside to living amongst humans. You can see the heads I win, tails you lose situation here that the Banu Nadir faced and had to work within. It had been and would be up to the modern day a very, very familiar position for Jewish communities. Stunningly so, really. Bafflingly so, how often this happens. And the relationship between Jewish communities and the rest of the world throughout history. Now, in this instance, I think this had more to do with Arab custom, just the old tribal paradigm, the way of thinking. I think that was a larger factor here than the more traditional phenomenon of anti-Semitism. But really, practically speaking, what does it matter? The result was the same. You can argue they weren't attacked for being Jewish, but they were Jews being attacked nonetheless, and I doubt they really cared about the reason. So, how did this play out on the ground? Well, fair or not, the Banu Nadir were given an ultimatum. Leave Medina in 10 days. but still retain a portion of the proceeds from the existing palm trees. Otherwise, you will all be killed. Now, among the Banu Nadir, at first the reaction was mixed among the people. At least we can keep our palm trees, right? But then again, when you think about it further, there really would be no way for the Banu Nadir to enforce that agreement. So in the end, realistically, they were probably leaving everything behind to start over someplace else. This was a good guess of what the practical reality would be. You know, if you're thinking about it cynically, this is much more likely to look like the end of Fiddler on the Roof than a generous profit-sharing proposal. So ultimately, initially, the Banu Nadir refused. When the refusal was made, Muhammad laid siege to the Banu Nadir for 15 days. And at that point, after 15 days, the Muslims began to destroy the palm trees. Now, my guess is these were date palms rather than ones with coconuts. I don't actually know a whole lot about trees, but I'm guessing that. So even if the Banu Nadir stayed, they would have nothing. So they re-entered negotiations with the Muslims and tried to get the original terms. But Muhammad basically told them to leave or die. They would leave their palm trees and weapons, and obviously their homes. Some of the less well-off emigrants from Mecca would move in. And this alleviated a housing shortage among the Muslims. And Muhammad also took some of this land for himself in this area. And you may notice a very ironic echo from our own time. Sometimes history just weaves a tale worthy of Shakespeare, a story with such unbelievable layer and depth. And whether this is pure coincidence is in the eyes of the beholder, but yes, this part, dripping irony and all, this actually happened. And unlike what we were talking about earlier, involving the angel Gabriel, this part, this was laid out in the Quran. This was in Surah 59, and it justifies the actions taken and lays out what's to be done with these spoils of war. For example, verses 2 to 5 emphasize the righteousness of the actions taken against the Banu Nadir. It says, "He," meaning God, "he is the one who expelled the disbelievers of the people of the book from their homes for their first banishment ever. You never thought they would go, and they thought their strongholds would put them out of Allah's reach. But the decree of Allah came upon them from where they never expected, and he cast horror into their hearts, so they destroyed their houses with their own hands and the hands of the believers. So take a lesson from this, O people of insight. Had Allah not decreed exile for them, he would have certainly punished them in this world, and in the hereafter they will suffer the punishment of the fire. This is because they defied Allah and his messenger, and whoever defies Allah, then Allah is truly severe in punishment. Whatever palm trees you believers cut down or left standing intact, it was all by Allah's will, so that he might disgrace the rebellious." Now, in addition to that, there were some verses that talked about who gets to benefit from this financial windfall. It came from this confiscated land. Now, verses 6 to 9 tells how this will all be divvied up, and also warns those not getting anything, hey, don't be bitter or jealous, even though this isn't for you. "As for the gains Allah has turned over to his messenger from them, you did not even spur on any horse or camel for such gains. But Allah gives authority to his messengers over whoever he wills. For Allah is most capable of everything. As for gains granted by Allah to his messenger from the people of other lands, they are for Allah and the messenger, his close relatives, orphans, the poor, the needy, travelers, so that wealth may not merely circulate among your rich. Whatever the messenger gives you, take it, and whatever he forbids you, leave it. And fear Allah, Surely Allah is severe in punishment. Some of the gains will be for poor emigrants who were driven out of their homes and wealth, seeking Allah's bounty and pleasure and standing up for Allah and His Messenger. They are the true ones in faith. As for those who had settled in the city and embraced the faith before the arrival of the immigrants, they love whoever immigrates to them, never having a desire in their hearts for whatever of the gains is given to the immigrants. They give the immigrants preference over themselves, even though they may be in need. And whoever is saved from the selfishness of their own souls, it is they who are truly successful. So the Banu Nadir were expelled. They weren't killed. They were expelled. This is important because they would end up going to a place called Khaybar, Khaybar, which was another Jewish community in Arabia. It's about 100 miles north of Medina, which is pretty important in a lot of ways, because from Muhammad's perspective, he would no longer have these people between him and Mecca. You know, having them to the north is wildly preferable to having them to the south or near Medina somewhere. Now, Khaybar, for Muhammad, was not strategically significant at the time. But remember that name, Khaybar, as well as that of the Banu Nadir, because this isn't over. This will not be the last fight between these people and the Muslims. Again, spoiler alert, there will be a Battle of Khaybar in the future. But for now, the Banu Nadir would not be fighting there. They would instead start to join what I would call an anti-Muhammad alliance. You know, you're going to hear the term confederation. The Quran uses this a lot in the English translation, but this is what they're talking about. They're not just fighting the Quraysh anymore. It's a confederation of tribes that they're counting with their own confederation of tribes. But when you hear the word confederations, they're always talking about the Quraysh and their people. Now, the Quraysh, like the Banu Nadir, they would be gathering resources and allies for the next large battle, which would not be for two more years, in the Battle of the Trench. Now, for now, the Banu Nadir would be a proxy in the Cold War between the Muslims and the Quraysh, although maybe the World War II term phony war might be more appropriate than a Cold War, because there would be skirmishes among both sides in this time, including some assassinations of Banu Nadir leaders. But for the most part, it was like the phony war in World War II, the Zitzkrieg, as they called it. That period in World War II where little fighting was happening, but a giant bloody mess would be reasonably expected in time. Now, in World War II, this was the time after the Allies, mainly Britain and France, they declared war on Germany due to the invasion of Poland by the Germans and the Soviets, but before the invasion of France by the German army. Now, for our purposes in ancient Arabia, the phony war period will be about 2 years, starting with the end of Uhud and going through the Battle of the Trench 2 years later. And like in World War II, there will be skirmishes, even some things that could be considered battles. And the casualties of this phony war, funny enough, would actually exceed those of the battle that they ended up leading up to. You know, so the comparison is far from perfect. Again, when we get to the Battle of the Trench, you're going to be stunned by these casualty figures. But if you take the human toll out of the equation, I actually believe this comparison is pretty appropriate and a helpful way to think about it. This period was a preparation, a prelude to something larger. Now, there would be several false starts and some bravado back and forth, but no major action. It was a Cold War, kind of, but a phony war. And one that everyone knew would eventually turn into a hot war. Thank you, and I'll talk to you next time. Inshallah. Thank you for listening to Islam for Christians. Please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you want to keep this show ad-free, you can also visit my Patreon page and subscribe. I'm at patreon.com/islamforchristians. That's patreon.com/islamforchristians.